This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. It would be hard to miss the headlines recently about Iran and the United States, including stories about a planned strike called off at the last minute, increasing sanctions, and the shooting down of a U.S. drone. We're going to spend some time talking about the history of the U.S. and Iran. Harold Boies, a retired Unitarian Universalist minister. He has taught history, among other subjects. He's also been active in groups around Kalamazoo, such as Kalamazoo Nonviolent Opponents of War. And Michael Cagney is a retired cardiothoracic surgeon in Kalamazoo. He came to the United States from his native country of Iran. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
As you look at what's happening right now with increasing tension between the U.S. and Iran, what do you look back to in history and say, that led us to here?
Well, I think that's a good start, because we have to see why this grievance, what is the problem with the Iranian government behaving like this. I think that the problem started first with the British discovery of oil back in 1903, William Darcy. Then they signed a contract for 50 or 60 years with Iranian monarch to explore the southern part of Iran for oil, to refine the oil, and to carry the oil around the world. But in the process, Iran had no voice in any profit that comes. They all told Iranian people that we're going to give you this much, whatever. So to make the story short, it happened to be for every barrel of oil that they exported from Iran, only gave maybe about a penny to the Iranian government. This went on up until 1951, when the prime minister of Iran, which was well-liked, very popular, democratically elected prime minister during Shah, who was, by the way, economist, was trained in France. I think he has a PhD in economy. He decided to nationalize Iranian oil. It took a couple years of negotiation, and he kept on insisting. Eventually, they nationalized oil. The British, of course, didn't like it. They started to siege Iran, the Persian Gulf. They brought ships to prevent any export of Iranian oil, which they succeeded to do that. But they decided that there's no way you can negotiate with Mossadegh, who was the prime minister, and they thought the best would be to overthrow him. They convinced the U.S. government, that was Eisenhower then, that Iran, if we don't do this, will be shifted toward Russia, toward communism. And this fear of communism was the reason why U.S. got involved with the British. And under the operation of Ajax, which was led by Kermit Roosevelt, they
And we should let's just note here that Kermit Roosevelt was the grandson of Theodore Roosevelt.
That's my understanding.
Yes.
That's my understanding.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. With the help of CIA and intelligence service of England, they were able to bring the Shah back, who then has left Iran because the uprising of the people, brought him back to Iran and overthrew Mossadegh. They jailed him, and eventually he died in seclusion. But this left a very bad taste in the Iranian psyche, that all you're interested is to take the cheap oil, and they don't care about the Iranian people. And CIA, by the way, 2 years after that, to prevent the infiltration of the Russian agents, the communist agents, came up to set up this secret police in Iran, which is called SAVAK. This SAVAK was basically set up by CIA and Mossad, the intelligence service of Israel. The goal of this was basically a combination of FBI and CIA together, the function, if you want to see how they work. So many Iranian people, so many students, University of Tehran, my classmates, were jailed, tortured. So many were killed by CIA. And this continued, and U.S. kept supporting Iran for this action, because for them, the most important thing was to prevent the USSR coming south, having any control over Iranian. which I understand their anxiety, but as a result, the Iranians suffered. And Shah became very arrogant. He kept on buying weapons from U.S. And during Nixon, he sort of became the police of Persian Gulf. And Shah, which was very egomaniac, unfortunately, at the end, he became crazy and did a lot of things, including, I think, went against West, raised the price of oil. And frankly, the West didn't like that. So they helped Khomeini, which was coming up gradually with the sending sermons from Iraq to Iranian people that you have to operate.
The Ayatollah Khomeini?
Yes.
Is who you're referring to?
Yes, okay. Yes. Ayatollah Khomeini, who was then exiled to Iraq, he kept on sending sermons, taped sermons, which were going to mosques and people listened to this. And he basically initiated the roots of revolution. And since people didn't like the present government, the Shah, Khomeini came up and everybody thought, okay, maybe he can come and change the system. They were hoping that they would bring a Republican, democratic Republican type of government. And that's what he promised while he was in France. But then, of course, everything changed. He came to Iran and gradually, within 6 months to a year, he said, no, has to be Islamic Republic, has to be Velayat, has to be supreme leader, non-elected supreme leader. This person would be in charge of the country. And basically, although Iran elects people to go for the parliament, but they are very much handpicked by the government. So I think the system is not the way it was supposed to be.
You came to the United States in 1970.
That is correct.
So you lived under a lot of this. How did you decide that you wanted to live in America, despite knowing this history of the U.S. government's involvement in your native country?
Good question. 1970, it took me 8 years to finish my postgraduate training. So when I finished was 1978. That was when I finished fellowship in Cleveland Clinic. My wife then was perfusionist. She was trained. And my plan was to go back to Iran, back home, and develop a cardiac surgery center. But then when I went back home for exploration, this is 1978. This is June 1978. I found out that it's very difficult to set up a practice. I have to have at least $200,000 to $300,000 to buy equipment to do this. And I could not be practicing if I wasn't a member or having a share of this hospital or that hospital. So I thought it's going to be very difficult to practice. And also at that time, I saw the unrest in Iran when I went to visit. I saw lots of people demonstrating in university, in the streets. So I thought the situation is very unstable. But still I had this idea to go home and open a big cardiac practice and help people. But it didn't work out. As you know, the revolution took place and my kids were all born here and it was very difficult to do. And I, to be honest with you, I thought it was a disservice to my children if I take them there, because they are going to have a good education here, which wasn't then the case in Iran. So this is the reason why I stayed.
So for a lot of people, if we're talking from 1953 forward, most of us cannot remember a time when there was not some tension between the United States and Iran, where the United States and Iran were not considered adversaries. Are they always destined to be adversaries?
No, it wasn't, really. I mean, truly, honestly, we always look at the U.S. as a free country, a freedom-loving nation, and they had nothing against U.S. except just admiration. Honestly, I'm telling you, and this is why so many of my classmates, I'm talking about the graduate of 1967, out of 300 graduates of that class, 132 of them came to U.S. And all of them are here. This is because the U.S. has such a good reputation helping other countries. And of course, what we saw in the moon landing by the U.S., and most of these development discoveries came from the United States. Well, Russia, our neighbor, had biggest stockpile of nuclear weapons, but we never saw anything coming out of Russia in form of a new car or something. Everything Iran imported was American, and they had this. In fact, during the revolution, you don't believe that 40,000 Americans were in Iran right at that moment when revolution took place and Khomeini took over. And every one of them returned back home safe and sound. And if you had a chance to talk to them, they all have good memories of Iranian people. Good memories. They're very hospitable, very respectful of America. So you might ask me what then happened. Basically, when Shah, this now I'm talking about 1979, revolution has taken place, Khomeini is in control, highly suspicious of the United States may bring the Shah back. Shah then has gone to Egypt and then from Morocco. And then we found out that he has lymphoma, which was hidden from Iranian people, this cancer. He had it at least for 6 years. CIA knew it, but not Iranian people. So when he got very bad, he was hospitalized in New York, Cornell, for radiation therapy, I believe, and chemotherapy. And Iranian thought, I'm talking about Iranian government, that U.S. has made the secret plan to bring the Shah back. Nothing could convince them that the Shah was sick. They thought it was fake. We never knew the Shah is sick. Suddenly they came up with this plan. This is to keep him there. And in the right moment, they come. And of course, the Iran Air Force was very strong. And there was some talk about bombing Khomeini's headquarters then in Iran, inside. So Iranians were highly suspicious of what's going to happen. So the student, when they attacked the U.S. embassy, first the government of Iran stopped them. But the second time, Khomeini said, no, these are they're spying on us. And basically, he supported their takeover. And at that time, the government of Iran resigned. I mean, those secular government that if you call them, you know, everybody resigned because they thought this was against all international laws. They should have not done that. And they couldn't convince Khomeini. As you know, the rest of it was they kept them for 444 days. And the operation of Desert in Tabas, when President Carter sent those helicopters, they failed because of the bad weather and sandstorm. And unfortunately, end up with some loss of lives. And the Iranians were able to capture the rest of them. So basically, this tension comes from 53. I think the whole thing comes from this misunderstanding, this suspicion, this feeling that the U.S. is constantly trying to overthrow their government. Now, they love to see the U.S. do this, but it's not possible.
They love to see the U.S. overthrow the Iranian government?
I believe so.
The Iranian people, you mean? The people, people on the ground. People you would have grown up with.
Yes, yes. Why? Because they found out this is not what they thought it's going to be.
You mean the Iranian government as it exists?
Present system. Yeah. Present system. The system is not working for the Iranian people as they claim. So there is a lot of unrest, unhappiness. But the people are not able to do much because who has the weapons? Plus, most of the people who work in the government, and lots of other people who are informer for the government, they are getting paid by the government. So you put yourself in their shoes. Would you revolt? No, because you know immediately if you do this, you are going to lose your job. You're going to lose your income. Your children are going to lose the income. And since the ordinary people don't have any means, and they have the guns. If Iran, anything happened in Iran, in a sense of another revolution, is going to be a bloody revolution because they will not spare using guns as Shah did. Shah specifically ordered his military not to fire on people. So it was very easy transition from what it was, in spite of being such a advanced military unit Iran had during Shah. They did not pull guns on the people of Iran. So just to keep coming forward here, Iran started to get involved in the uranium business. Perhaps they never claimed they were going to make the bomb, but they got involved by purchasing secretly some of this centrifuge from Pakistan. But before I come to that, I want to mention this. It's a very important historical point. This is 1980. September 80, Saddam Hussein from Iraq invaded Iran, fearing that Iran-Iranian revolution may filter into Iraq. And the Gulf nations, Saudis, one of them, and the rest of Emirates, they promised, including Kuwait, they promised Saddam that they will pay for expenses. They invaded Iran. They killed lots of people. Iranian people who were very emotional and very nationalist about their country, they fought back. And Iran probably lost close to 600,000 of its youngs. War lasted 8 years. And the U.S. sided with the Iraq toward the end. And when Saddam Hussein, dropped chemical bombs on the Iranian west coast or west part of Iranian border, CIA came out and said this was the work of Iranian government, that Iran never had chemical weapon, never had chemical weapon. In fact, if I say anything about Khomeini, he said nobody should have any mass destruction weapons, including atomic weapon or chemical weapon or biological weapon. Iran never had any of these things. But anyway, just to go back what CIA did, CIA backed up Saddam Hussein, especially in the issue of chemical weapons. And this has remained also very fresh in memory of every Iranian people, that look, U.S. is not interested to you guys. U.S. is interested only in his own interest, which is in a way true, by the way. They don't give a damn about what Hussein does to Iran, what Saddam Hussein did to Iran. As long as they can stop Iran from taking over Iraq, they will be happy. So this is another part to this story. And as you know, in 1988, Iranian passenger carrying close to 300 people over the Gulf of Oman going to Dubai from Iran was shot down by USS Vincent, thinking that this was a missile coming to them, which I was so shocked because U.S. has such a sophisticated radar system. How could you not? And then they were in the legitimate airspace. They did not exceed their tunnel, whatever they're supposed to be. And they sent signal on the civilian signaling system, not the military system as U.S. claimed, because U.S. investigated this. 4 weeks later, they found this was all lies, that the U.S. did shoot them. I'm not saying the commander did that purposely. Maybe he was very nervous thinking they are missile because... But Iranians are the one who lost close to 300 people. Out of these, 60 were children. And nobody talks about this, right? Nobody talks about this. So coming, Iran signed the contract during Obama, which was extremely good agreement. Not what I say, but based on most expert in nuclear physics. In the U.S., 500 of them signed that this was a good, and the U.S. did a great job to make sure Iran does not evade. 24-hour surveillance of Iran, the most intrusive inspection the planet has ever seen so far. Iranian uranium mines, the number of centrifuge, and the inspection which continuously goes on. And every time the United Nations Atomic Agency certifies that Iran has remained stuck to the deal, did not violate the deal. European allies say the same thing. Russia and China say the same thing. They are the signatory. Iran, in a spot, and then President Trump, based on pressure from Netanyahu and the hardliner in the White House, including Mr. Bolton, was convinced that this is not a good deal for U.S., tears this deal, and put the most severe sanction against Iranian people. I'm saying against Iranian people because the government always get enough money to satisfy them.
Sanctions will always hit the people on the ground.
Always. The marginal people, the people who are the middle class, now has become the lower class. And I know this because my own family, that never needed my help. My wife and myself, I have to send them money, which is shocking to me. How could my sister, who is a teacher, or my brother-in-law, who is a professor of university, now they have to have this kind of life that I have to help them?
I'm sorry. You know, Harold has been waiting patiently here. I'd like to have him come in and say a little bit. So let's Harold, I want to start from there with the idea that, you know, as Dr. Cagney said, there are people in Iran who probably would like to see some sort of U.S. involvement. Sanctions do hit people who are at the lower end of the socioeconomic ladder hardest. Mm-hmm. So what does the U.S. do about that? I mean, if sanctions are going to hit, you know, the wrong people, and if military action brings, of course, its own complications, what else is there?
Well, you asked before, could we ever be friends again with Iran? And decidedly so. I mean, look, we're friends with Germany. We're friends with Japan. These things ebb and flow, you know, relationships. I think what's important for us Americans to understand is the forces that are creating this animus, this hatred of Iran, and how it's hurting us. And the reason that we focus on 1953 is because before 1953, the Iranian people, you know, they trusted Americans. They loved Americans, like Dr. Cagney pointed out. And we've had these forces that have been pushing us apart. And I like to say that we both agree that we don't like theocracy. We don't like the government in Iran. But we also don't like theocracy in Saudi Arabia and Israel. And those are our allies. And those two countries have their problems with violations of human rights. It's not as if we're approving of Iran, but the point is, what's in our interests? And I don't think it's in our interest to create permanent war and to create hatred for Americans. And that's what we're doing. I'd like to read this excerpt from a book called All the Shah's Men, An American Coup and the Roots of the Middle East Terror, written by Stephen Kinzer, who's a New York Times reporter. He's been to 50 countries, and he was the first New York Times bureau chief in Istanbul. And he also co-authored a book called Bitter Fruit, The Story of the American Coup in Guatemala. Okay, he also co-authored the book Bitter Fruit, The Story of the American Coup in Guatemala. And I'm going to get to that in a little bit about this was the first time in 1953 that the CIA was used to orchestrate a coup. Before that, under Truman, the CIA was used to gather intelligence and do analysis and that kind of thing. So Truman wouldn't approve of a coup. But after that, the CIA has been used in many contexts to overthrow governments, which is really remarkable. I mean, can you imagine if some country tried to do that in our country, try to overthrow our government? But he begins in his preface about a woman, older Iranian woman who wrote memoirs, and she was talking about, you know, what happened to Mossadegh. And then it was brought up about the coup, and then she said this: "Why do you Americans do that terrible thing?" she cried out. "We always loved America. To us, America was the great country, the perfect country, the country that helped us while other countries were exploiting us, primarily Great Britain." you know, with the oil. But after that moment, no one in Iran ever trusted the United States again. I can tell you for sure that if you had not done that thing, you would never have had the problem of hostages being taken in your embassy in Tehran. All your troubles started in 1953. Why did you do it? And if you read the story, the big reason was because of oil. It was because of greed. That was a big reason. The secondary reason was because of the fear of communism. And Mossadegh was not a communist. And like you pointed out, that actually Iranians have kind of a diffident, they don't like Russians very much because of their history. But I want to do a final thing here that Kinzer said. In his time, the violent anti-Americanism that emerged from Iran after 1979 shocked most people in the United States. So when we talk about the history of Iran, most Americans think of 1979. That's what they think of. Iranians think of 1953. History is very important because people remember. The Zionists think of what happened in the 30s and 40s, you know, during the Holocaust. There's some people in this country that are still attached to what happened in the Civil War back in the 1860s. Of course, for the beginning of the garrison state in this country, we think of December 7th, 1941. It's not as if the United States has always been doing the wrong thing, but they've been doing a lot of wrong things, in particular in using the CIA to do nefarious things, such as trying to overthrow countries. And so Americans don't understand why is there anti-Americanism. And it's because of government policies that are militaristic, that go to the dark side, that use all these methods that are, just bad methods. I don't want to say evil, but anyway, Americans had no idea. This is, again, Kinzer. Americans had no idea what might have set off such bitter hatred in a country where they always imagined themselves more or less well-liked. And that's my friend that I knew as a political science professor, was Iranian, would say that. He didn't like the theocracy in Iran, but he said Iranians like Americans. That was because almost no one in the United States knew what the Central Agency did back there in 1953. Operation Ajax, as a CIA coup against Mossadegh, was codenamed, was a great trauma for Iran, the Middle East, and the colonial world. It was the first time the United States overthrew a foreign government. It set a pattern for years to come and shaped the way millions of people view the United States. So you ask, what can we do? Well, what we can do is stop doing what we have been doing. And we stop this militarism and stop this bellicose kind of attitudes. I mean, I think of people like John Bolton. He's one of those what you call chicken hawks who during the Vietnam War joined the Guard so he didn't have to fight in the war like George W. Bush did. I was against the war. So I'm glad it didn't go. I'm very fortunate that I didn't go and fight in that terrible war. That was a big mistake. But, our policy have been over the years since World War II have been to use the military first rather than diplomacy and rather to try to make relationships work. And I think one of the big reasons that we have problems with Iran, we could attribute to one man, Benjamin Netanyahu, who has since 1992 has told people and has lied to people saying that Iran is going to have nuclear weapons in 1 to 2 years or 3 to 5 years. He's been doing this over and over again since 1992. And there were times that he wanted us, the United States, to attack Iran. And I think a big part of that reason, it's not because he's afraid of Iran invading Israel. That wouldn't make sense. I mean, especially since Israel has the biggest military in the Middle East and also has nuclear weapons. But I think they're afraid of Iran's influence, much like Osama bin Laden was afraid of American influence. You know, he didn't like how American culture was affecting the world. I think Netanyahu in particular, is afraid of Iran having a bigger influence in the Middle East. And so he is promoting this idea of attack, this idea of using the military, of using violence as a means to an end. And, you know, the bottom line is, it's really amazing that these people who have promoted using the military in the past, like, for example, in Iraq, and have gotten, in Afghanistan, for that matter, have gotten such terrible results. Why are these people being listened to? Why are we not listening to the voices of reason and to the voices that promote diplomacy? So you ask, Gordon, what can we do? Well, we can promote diplomacy. We can promote dialogue. We can promote listening. And primarily, we can promote understanding one another. And we don't. That doesn't mean that we approve of that regime, but we're willing to work with them.
Okay, we've been here for a little bit. Let me get to this question.
Yeah.
How concerned should the U.S. be about the possibility of Iran having the ability to develop a nuclear weapon?
Well, I think very much so. But I'm an abolitionist. In fact, you know, my father was a nuclear physicist, and he worked in a plant that enriched uranium-238 to 235, making fissile so that it would be for bombs and so on. And I've always been an abolitionist, and it would be a very big concern. But the thing is, we had this agreement that Obama orchestrated, created, that worked and that would prevent Iran from getting a bomb. And it was the most stringent kind of agreement that you can imagine. And, you know, the question I ask, you know, why does it make sense that Iran can't build its nuclear weapons and Israel and the United States have nuclear weapons? I never understood that. You know, why are we in Israel allowed to have nuclear weapons, but they are not? I mean, we should get rid of our weapons, and Israel and everybody else, for that matter.
So, but Dr. Kagan, yeah. Let me turn to you on that. I mean, as an Iranian, do you take that point that if the United States can have nuclear weapons, Israel, other countries, why not Iran?
No, I'm against any kind of nuclear weapon. I mean, I'm thinking like you, Harold. I don't like Iran ever have nuclear weapon because suppose Iran has just a limited stockpile. First of all, Israel would not allow this to happen. They will bombard Iran and more in U.S. for that matter. Secondly, suppose for some reason they sneak in and we just make... That is not going to help the defense of Iran. When you have the Russia with 2,000 warheads in north, we have Pakistan with 100, and Israel 250, and submarine warhead right in the Persian Gulf from Israel. How good this is not going to be securing Iran. So I am all for not having nuclear weapon, period, but now that we have it, to stop proliferation. And when this
to stop proliferation, exactly, mean not in Iran?
In any part of the world.
No country that's not in the nuclear club now should get to join?
Exactly, exactly. At least we would limit the ability of some nations to have this. Because I don't think we can use it as sort of defense anymore, except killing innocent people, right? We all know that. We don't have to go over what the nuclear weapon does to you. Iran, however, it may be that some people, hardliner, they love to have. But fortunately, with the present agreement, the intrusiveness of this inspection, which is 24 hours a day, Iran had no way to evade the term of the agreement. They were supposed to make only up to 3.5%. In order to make a great weapon, you need 90%, 200 uranium-235. Uranium-235 is only 0.4% of the uranium ore. So you have to separate. It takes awful long time to separate 0.4 from 97.6% impurity of uranium-238. So it's not easy task to do it or reach that point. So Iranian already being inspected continuously. This was not the reason why, that's at least I don't understand, why Trump suddenly came out of this agreement, which was, in my opinion, if they have anything, half of this with North Korea, we should be very happy, right? Iran was following everything based on what the I'm not arguing that maybe some still are trying to. It's like you think, what am I thinking in my head? That doesn't matter. What I do is matter. Iranian are not able to exceed the 3.5 limit based on the agreement. So they have stayed loyal to that agreement all the way. And I'm not, as I said, the European all agree with this. So is the United Nations. And the U.S. knows that too. So does the Israel. But why they're doing to Iran like this, I don't understand. I don't know why they're going to hurt Iranian people.
Mm-hmm. You know, I would say we should look at the motivation of Iran, why they would want to have a nuclear weapon. And I think it's important to note that those countries that have nuclear weapons don't get invaded, like North Korea, for example. You know, Gaddafi in Libya gave up his nuclear weapons, and look what happened to him. Same thing with Saddam Hussein. You know, he didn't have nuclear weapons, and the United States knew that. And so they could invade easily without worrying about a nuclear weapon going to Tel Aviv or Jerusalem or something like that. So it's understandable why they would want a weapon, because they don't want to be invaded. And they're much more likely to be invaded by Israel and the United States than the other way around. I mean, they're not a threat to us, and they're not a threat to Israel. But Israel and the United States are definitely threats to Iran, and they feel that, and they understand that. And that's why they're motivated to want to have a weapon now, you know, after Trump got out of that agreement. It's just really crazy, I think.
Harold Boy and Dr. Michael Cagney, thank you very much for your time.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Gordon.
You can subscribe to WMUK's West Southwest podcast through Apple Podcasts and by searching podcasts in Google Music. It can also be found at our website, WMUK.org, and through the WMUK app. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.